Yes, that's about what you need. A hook, a sinker of line, and probably a little bit of luck. A little bit of skill wouldn't hurt. But Fishing Frank here, and this is Radio Fishing. I guess that's what we decided on it. Anyway, Fishing Frank in the chair, Robert in the chair across from me. We got Captain Morris Campbell with me. And in the control booth, it's RJ, the one with the least enviable job of all, controlling us. All right, lots of stuff going on out there. Fishing's actually, this has been a kind of a strange fall because everybody's talking about gloom and doom, and it's been a better than average August so far as fish catching goes in Charlotte Harbor. Now, we're talking about a line between Cape Hayes and Boquilla inside. Matt Lachey's been doing real good. The area around Matt Lachey's kicking butt. All up through the harbor, the east side, west side, Punta Gorda, Port Charlotte, El Jabin. There's a lot of different fish around. Still having some issues along the ICW, the Intercoastal Waterway, with as far as some red tides kicking up. And those are going off all the way up, way north of us to way south of us. But it seems to pop up, get real bad, and then go away. But the one thing that's popping up and not going away yet is the black drum. A lot of black drum around. I mean, there is schools out there, and they're admittedly, it's getting a little late for them. If you haven't found them yet, this weekend would be your time. If you get some decent calm water out there, if the wind's not blowing too much, get out right around Charlotte Harbor looking for these schools. This is something you're going to remember the rest of your life. It's going to take you 3 to 5 minutes just to remember to pick up your fishing pole. I mean, seriously, you're going to see this and 1,060-pound fish acting like a school of minnows. And if you're 14 feet of water, they're going to be skimming the bottom all the way to the surface. These are some amazing fish and amazing pattern out there. It could be a spawning pattern. It could be a feeding pattern. It could be almost anything. But everybody's complaining right now. Now, Robert, you might be able to be the one. Robert's our walking encyclopedia. We are strongly urging people to catch and release the black drum. Yes, you gotta go up about 4 inches higher right to where the part on the hair is. As you peel the hair over to the side, you can get to the different pages.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mention that there's a lot less pages than there used to be.
A whole lot less pages.
Oh, boy.
I didn't say it. You started it. This wasn't me. This was you.
Grass doesn't grow on the busy street, does it, Robert?
See, okay. If you'd think a little less, you know, you would have all that up, you know. So, anyway, catch and release black drum. Yeah. And this is not a time of year to keep them. There's so many parasites in the drum. They don't hurt you. They're not going to bother you.
No, they won't. You know, and parasite is a generalized statement. These are a worm that is inside the meat of the fish, and they're very predominant this time of year. So,
oh, yeah, especially the bigger ones.
There's no reason to kill a bigger black drum this time of year. If you want to try a, you know, a little 18 to 24 incher, go for it. You should be pretty good, but even on the big ones, you can still eat them because it's not a parasite that can be transmitted from the fish to the human. Your biggest problem that you're going to have of any fish is cooking it improperly. That could make you sick.
As long as you cook it properly, the meat's fine.
Right.
But now, what these parasites actually are, now, Robert and I are driving up to do the show. You know, we're at Fish and Frank's there in Port Charlotte, and we've got a lot of stuff going on. We're doing about an average August business, maybe a little bit slower, but we've got a big remodel coming up. We rent 2 units there now, and we're going to be taking over 2 more. And so the store's going to be about twice its size. We got a lot of preparations going on because that's going to happen in August. So Robert and I are busy trying to get all this stuff together, getting products together, because we've got to add almost twice the products we have now. We were walking around the spring going, well, maybe we can start hanging stuff off the ceilings, and we already do, but, you know, this kind of worked out. So with the neighbors going out, we're going to have the whole back parking lot, all of the front parking lot. It's going to be interesting. But we're on our way up, and we're heading up to Northport here to WKDW, the mighty one here in Northport at 97.5 FM, for those of you listening on the internet. At KDW.com. Is it WKDW? No, it's KDW.
KDWRadio.com.
KDWRadio.com. I knew I was missing part of it. All right. And so we called Greg Palatka at the Florida Marine Research.
Correct.
So we call up Greg and we said, Greg, what are these things? What are... And for all the world, they look like a giant sperm. I mean, they got a big, round, white head and a long, skinny tail. They're white. I mean, I don't know what other common reference I could use for it.
That'd be a pretty good, accurate description.
Big, round, white head, little, skinny, squiggly tail on them, and they exist in the meat of black drum, sail cats, sea trout, red grouper.
Redfish.
Redfish. Sometimes. Seldom, but occasionally.
Cleaned a few.
Yeah,
Still a lot. The main thing is a lot of them are in the drum family.
Yeah, it's the drum family mainly.
You know, trout, redfish, and black drum are all in the same drums. Family.
Yeah, I mean, we don't see sea trout and black drum and redfish being the same genetics, but they are, and that's why the parasites roam between them. But these are actually not. These are actually a tapeworm, and this is the baby stage of it, the larval stage.
Yeah.
Well, you were on the phone with him, same as me. We're talking to Greg coming up here. We got him on speakerphone. I mean, he's looking at me like, well, let me think about that. I'm like, wait a minute.
I'm trying to refresh my brain with the conversation because he overloaded us with a lot of different information, so I'm trying to reflect back on it.
Oh, I only hear what I want to hear.
Yeah, I know.
His processors are still processing.
It takes him a while, you know. Okay, Robert, throw it low gear. We're going to chug through this.
Now you said tapeworm. People got to keep in mind that there's a bunch of different species of tapeworm.
I would say thousands.
I'm not even going to guess because I have no clue, but there's a lot of them. And it is not the type of tapeworm that can be transmitted from fish to human.
No.
So even if you ate it raw, which not recommended, it's still not going to be able to transfer into your body.
Yeah.
That's a totally different type of tapeworm that people get than this one.
And my family, we have a real strong family tradition. My ancestors, you know, troglodytes, and we started cooking with fire many years ago in our family. And, you know, right from the troglodyte to present-day troglodyte, we're still cooking our fish. You know, sushi is not an option. Although I have done it a few times, it's okay, but it's got to be the right fish. All right, black drum's not one. I love black drum because they're big, flaky meat. You get a huge slab of meat on it. You can use steak sauces. You can use anything you want on this meat. It's literally awesome. I love flaying out a big black drum. I don't do it often, and I only do it in the middle of winter. Because for some reason or another, these parasites, you know, white goblin-looking things inside the meat, do not seem to be there in the winter the way they are in the summer. Now, we were talking to Greg about that, and he disagrees entirely. He says that they don't get rid of the parasites. The fish is eaten by something larger, and like sharks. The sharks, when a shark eats them, and then these parasites attach themselves into the intestines and stuff of the shark. And then once they grow and they get to be adult, as the shark poops, they deposit the eggs out from these tapeworms.
Right.
And the shark poop goes to the bottom, and that's eaten by little tiny creatures like shrimp-type things. And
they're called copepods.
Copepods. All right. Now, what are copepods?
They're in the shrimp family. They're okay. Just a little tiny, tiny shrimp, like you were saying. But copepods are so tiny because the eggs are almost microscopic that are being
Gotcha.
Defecated out by the animals. That's the beginning of the life, is basically when the shark defecates the eggs out.
Poops.
Then they're...
Got it.
Then you guys are making this drum less and less appetizing as we go, you know.
But no, it's the shark poops. Little tiny things eat the poop, which is kind of like what happens everywhere. You know, bacteria eat every other... And these are little tiny shrimp, crab-type things. And then those are eaten by fish.
By other fish.
Or bigger creatures.
Or black drum or whatever.
And as these creatures are eaten by other things, the eggs kind of go through, and they work their way up the food chain where the black drum are eating the bigger shrimp, the crabs, all that kind of stuff. And that's how they get this parasite inside of them. It grows, gets in their stomach, and then works its way into the meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then it lives there until something bigger eats that fish.
Right.
Now, we are at odds with the biologists on this, because, now, Morris, you've caught as many of these big fish as anybody on the planet. There is, arguably, you can say, people may have caught as many, but few people have caught more. Do you see a difference in the black drum parasites in the summer versus the winter, or do you think it's the same all year?
No, all the fish in general, it's, when it's colder, there are less worms in there. I mean, you know, I know the scientists disagree with that, but, you know, the scientists aren't actually out there every day cleaning these fish and doing this, that, and the other. They're literally, you know, making data and making assessments from collected samples, but these samples aren't everyday samples. They're random samples.
So you're like me. I'm assuming you enjoy eating black drum every once in a while.
My favorite recipe for the black drum, and this is a little known fact, that it came from Italy.
Alright.
Okay. The black drum. They fillet the black drum, they lay it out flat with the skin on it and the worm side up. They put a lot of spaghetti sauce on it and a lot of cheese, and they just have it. That's where the whole idea for pasta came from, a filleted black drum.
No, okay, now wait a minute.
wait,
RJ.
One of my legs is a little bit longer. I think somebody's been yanking on it.
All right. Now, come on. You got to go either further or back up.
I like the black drum. I like the black drum blackened is my favorite way. And the second favorite way, we used to prepare them when my grandmother and mother prepared them when I was a little boy. And my dad and grandpa were catching them. They would put them with the skin side down, and they would bake them. And they would put a variety of things on, which I really don't know what they put on them, but they tasted good to me. And we never, when it was set on the table, there was never a worm in it. It was just tasty, good eating. But people always considered that drum a trash fish. People back in that day considered redfish a trash fish.
Redfish, it was somewhere in the... maybe the 90s before anybody kept a redfish. I have thousands of pictures from the 80s and the 90s, and there's only a couple of redfish. Now, as the years went on, they became more of a thing, but redfish was just considered a saltwater carp and not good for anything. Black drum were not considered a really good fish except by the locals. But even the locals didn't like the red drum, and it's not surprising because at one point, as everybody knows, snook was considered a trash fish. Mm-hmm. Literally, like people do catfish now, snook and catfish were on the same level.
Soapfish.
Yeah, they were considered garbage. But with these black drum and the copepods it starts with a shark that has a tapeworm. And when the shark poops, the tapeworm eggs go out with the shark poop. It goes to the bottom. The little tiny shrimp and everything else eat that, right?
Correct.
Okay. And then bigger fish and crabs and other things eat those animals.
Yep.
And then eventually into the size of animals that we're eating.
Yes.
Where the argument comes in is between us who are fishermen and deal with the fish on a weekly, monthly basis, daily basis, we see a very high concentration of parasites in the late summer, early fall, and then by December, January, February, we see almost no parasites at all in the fish, little to none. And the scientists say that that is not true, and we're telling them, well, you got to be there.
Well, Greg didn't say it's not true. He just didn't know for sure what the life cycle was of it. He thought it was an interesting proposal, and he'd want to look into it to see if anyone has done a study. But as far as he was aware of, nobody has done a study on that.
So in other words, I'm right and everybody else is wrong.
As usual.
Okay. I can live with that. All right.
I'm going to hazard a guess here. You were saying that the worm is the larval stage?
Yes.
So there's another stage beyond that, and it's probably where that worm moves into the intestines, leaves the flesh, goes into the intestines.
Of a larger predator.
And does its thing in there. And so that's why when you get the black drum, if you had caught him in the summertime, he's got the larval stage going on inside of him, which is in the meat. And then when you catch him if you caught that same fish in January, the larval stage is over. They've gone to whatever their next stage is, probably in the intestines. And so that's why you don't see as many, if none at all, in the fish in the colder weather.
And that's what we believe. We believe that either the parasites change and, like you say, maybe go to the intestine or actually leave the fish going to look for a shark or something, because that's where they ultimately want to live. And waiting around for, you know, the whole life of the fish to be eaten by a shark is kind of a waste of a lot of time. You know, you gotta...
I'm not sure the worms wear watches, so I don't think they care.
Yeah, but the worms are pretty patient.
Yeah,
but still, okay, nature's usually pretty efficient. And okay, I'm just going to hang out in this thing, not reproducing, not doing anything, until one day it get eaten by a shark. I think they leave and go looking for a shark. That, to me, seems like... Now, Robert, are you going to weigh in, or just give me these dirty looks?
Not give me any dirty looks. I honestly don't know. I mean, I have no idea what the life cycle is of that. I mean, I know that the tapeworms that I have encountered over the years with reptiles, the animal lives in its intestinal tract. The adult animal is in the intestinal tract, and every time they defecate the egg sac out. And that's where they live and die, is in that intestinal tract. So I don't know if at a larval stage, like RJ was saying, maybe they do leave the muscle tissue and move into other organs inside the fish that we just don't see because we discard that.
Yeah, I actually have never cleaned the intestinal tract of a black drum.
I mean, everyone looks at the stomach contents of fish on a regular basis, but who actually unzips the intestines and looks at that?
I'm admitting, never done it.
I'm not a biologist, so I've never had really want, need, right. or desire to look at that.
Wahoo have a very specific parasite that lives their entire life cycle out, and every wahoo has one of these in his stomach.
Really?
Every wahoo you catch, if you open that stomach, you'll find this little parasite, and he's shaped like a little orb shape, and he's in there, and he'll crawl around if you set him on the fillet table.
Really?
You'll move around.
Similar to that critter that lives inside the mouth of the manhaden.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I forget the name of
that one, too. Oh, those little square-looking things?
Yeah, but it's...
Yeah.
It's more worm-like in the wild.
Okay. All right, so, you know, humans get tapeworms, everything has all this. I know it's been kind of a disgusting topic, but it's a really interesting one. And the one thing you have to understand, what does it have to do with catching them and all that? The more you understand a fish, where it goes, how it eats, how it lives, the more likely you can catch them. If you know nothing at all about a fish, you're probably not going to catch as many.
Well, look at that frog yesterday. There's another perfect example.
Oh, yeah.
It's been so long since you had seen one.
Robert caught this frog. Okay, go ahead and explain.
Cuban tree frog.
You got a Cuban tree frog. And they threw it out in the water to see if the fish would hit it.
Yeah.
And it swam right back up to us by there. And I said, wait a minute. I wasn't here. Throw it back out there. So they toss it back out in the water. And we had two young guys there trying to help us. I got termite tending on my house this week. So I had guys out there helping. And two of the younger guys, and they're looking at me like, why would you... I said, this is how you work a topwater. Watch that frog.
Right.
The way that frog moves, how he goes, how he stops, how fast he works, everything about it, that's a topwater lure presentation mm-hmm. in its purest form. And if you'll study how a frog swims across, you can work a topwater better. You will catch more fish. Period.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And
so I was enthralled. I was just sitting there. It's been a long time since I watched a frog swim. And I literally was counting, you know, how many seconds, you know, he moved. He actually did about four strokes and then paused on the average.
Yep.
But this frog was going somewhere, so he wasn't doing as much stopping. But it was literally about a four-stroke average, four kicks, I should say. Kick, 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 and then kind of paused. And yeah. then he'd do the kicks again. And watching that, it was kind of weird to actually starting to see a rhythm on that frog, but that's what I was counting. And I was literally counting it like if you were kind of maybe my music background were I'm not a great bass player, so I count everything. That keeps me where I got to be. And that's what I was doing with the frog. It was like learning music, you know, boom, 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 pause. That's the same cadence I was using there. Getting into something a little more interesting and a lot less disgusting, what's going on in the deep blue water?
Well,
Morris Campbell.
This is a time of year when all the pelagic species are out there off our coast, and they're in closer. They're within range of the normal grouper fisherman guys, and that you'll always hear the stories. Well, we were on our grouper hole in 60 feet or 70 feet or 80 feet or however deep you want to talk about, and all of a sudden our boat was surrounded with mahi-mahi dolphin, and we couldn't get them to bite, you know, or we caught a few of them and then they left or that, and then we went back to grouper fishing and didn't catch much. And my question is, well, why didn't you go fish for the dolphin? Well, we did. They came around the boat. But no, you didn't. So in all these pelagic species really inhabit our coastline year-round. They're just a lot farther out in the wintertime. You have blackfin tuna. You have the little tunies out there. You have wahoo. You have mahi-mahi, dolphin fish. All the billfish species live here. That's blue marlin, white marlin, sailfish, and spearfish. We have all of those here. So anything you could encounter in the Keys or on the East Coast, we have it here. It actually comes through here before it goes to the Keys and the East Coast.
Now, here's a question. Yesterday you went out, and how deep of water did you stop first?
Our first stop was in 285 feet along a big break line out off of Boca Grande. And there was
how many miles out is that?
That's about 82 miles out.
82 miles. That was your first stop.
That was our first area, and we looked around a bit there and trolled. We didn't raise anything, and then I got to noticing that, you know, we didn't have the normal southerly loop current there that we normally. There's about a 2-knot current that flows to the south.
All right. Now, even if you're at the beach, say you go out to Englewood Beach and you jump in the water and you're swimming, playing around, and you'll notice that when you go to get out of the water, your blanket and everything is way off to your left. It's up there a ways. Because it's about a 2-mile-an-hour southerly current goes across there. Mm-hmm. It's not always constant, but as a general rule, that's about it. But that current can actually slow down at times, go in, go out.
Yeah.
So you can be out there in 80, 100 feet of water and literally have no current at all.
It's literally a body of water within a body of water. Think of it as a river with no banks. So that river's is going to constantly flow, but without the banks to keep it in its certain position, it can shift in, it can shift out, or it can develop what we call eddies and have little spinoffs of current that come off of it. But these are, by little, I'm talking maybe a 50-mile area.
Right. What we're speaking of is the actual Gulf Stream current, and the current starts in the Gulf of Mexico in a big loop coming around, like, say, from Mexico to Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, in that kind of a loop. It starts on the western side, comes across the northern Gulf, and comes down on Florida side. So we're always having a north to south current here. But at some points, while you're grouper fishing, all of a sudden the tide, quote-unquote tide, stops. And that's actually that current has moved a little bit to one point or another because there's a river of water in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, we also have a river of water in the Atlantic. And that river of water comes around the Florida Keys, the Gulf Current, goes up along Florida and shoots over. That's what hits Great Britain, France, you know, Ireland, and all of them over there. That's what keeps them warm, keeps their climate, because the water around them is warm. If it wasn't for that river of water within the Atlantic, they would be the same basic temperatures as Greenland, Iceland, Alaska. They wouldn't be warm.
Absolutely.
They would be horribly cold, basically unlivable islands, but the Gulf Stream does that. So that same river of water goes around the Gulf, but it can move and cause eddies and stop. So if there is no current, there's probably not going to be any fish there.
Right.
How far out did you have to go to find these fish?
Well, we ran another 10, 12 miles out, and we found the current out there. We found the sargasso weed lines, and we found a bunch of different things. There were sailfish, white marlin.
All right, now, sargasso line, what are we, a little more layman than that.
Okay, it's a yellow weed. It has little balls on it that cause it to float. All of the blue water areas have it. Robert,
it's sargasso weed. It's basically, you know, the little air plants that grow in the trees around here,
right.
The little gray puff balls. It actually, the best way to describe it, it looks similar to those, and it's free-floating in massive mats out there on the water.
So,
and
it's bright yellow, though.
Yeah, it's bright yellow.
Now, can it be green as well, or
nope,
is that a different kind of plant?
Different animal.
So you're looking for kind of a yellow mat of weeds. Is there anything special you do to find it? Or?
You just have to use your eyes and look, and definitely, you know, you usually want to run east to west because most of these things are, you know, laying north to south because the current flows and wind. Just think of this, that you're out in 400 feet of water, and fish love structure. You know, this is going back to my, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old readings of Buck Perry's spoon plugging books, you know, back in the old days. Fish love structure. So they will congregate around structure. There's not a lot of structure in 400 feet of water. So a floating mat of thick vegetation is structure because it provides shade, it provides shelter for bait fish.
I would say, wouldn't the bait fish all come up and want to hide in that grass?
Literally thousands of bait fish.
If you're just a bait fish swimming in open water, like, anything's going to try and eat you.
Mm-hmm. Crabs, shrimp, and here's one that a lot of people don't realize, baby tarpon that have just hatched out.
So mm-hmm. baby tarpon are part of the minnow structure out there.
They sure are. They're translucent when they're first hatched out. So they have a cloaking device. They're so translucent you could barely see them if he was in the water.
Sargassum grass is actually one of the main life sources for all of our species of fish out there in the open ocean. A lot of different animals use it for protection and for food source, for starting off as microscopic eggs to a fish. I mean, sea turtle babies float on sargasso mats all the time. It's very, very common.
We saw them yesterday.
I'm going to come right back to that. Where does this come from? Is it something that grows in the bottom and then breaks away and floats to the top?
No, it's a
or
surface.
Or is it a shore?
It's
line?
A surface growing plant in the open ocean.
So it's literally just free floating, but that's the way it's supposed to be. It's free floating.
Yeah. And when you have real bad tropical storms here that are, you know, let's say 50 or 100 miles offshore, it's not unusual to have clumps of it actually blowing into shore. I've seen it several different times.
I've gone to the beach and seen sargassum grass all over the place.
And you'll actually find one species of fish that literally lives its entire life in that grass, and it's called a sargassum fish.
It only lives in that.
You will not find it anywhere else. All your other fish use it as just kind of a stepping point in their lifespan from one thing to another, but a sargassum fish lives its entire existence in that grass.
All right. Morris, How big were these? You saw turtles in the grass? How big are they?
Yeah, they're baby turtles. When they hatch out and they leave our beaches and go out,
inch, 2 inches?
I would say the biggest one we saw yesterday was probably 5 inches in diameter on the shell.
A hatchling when it's born is about 3 inches.
So these are ones that have left our beaches on this last turtle spawn. And they've made their way that far offshore, and they float around out there, eat little things that they can get their mouths on, and they're safe because they're definitely bait at that size.
Everything wants to eat them.
Yeah.
Great food. All right. If you see this grass, now, most of the time, it's going to mean a longer stretch going north to south. So you don't go troll or cast at it. Do you troll alongside of it, right?
Yeah, you can go alongside it. You can also pull up to it and cast or drop live baits down. That's not nearly as effective as, you know, putting a spread of rig ballyhoo out or some trolling feathers and trolling lures and just trolling down the side of it, and you don't have to be right up against it. You could be 30, 40 yards away from it because these fish swim at 40 to 70 mile an hour and they have no problem running out and hitting something.
I usually, when I've done it, I usually like to be about 30 feet away. If you're too close, I'm going to get right up there and catch all these fish, you're going to be pulling so many weeds out of your lures and everything else. You spend all your time doing that and you don't catch any fish. My thing is, I want to be close. I'm a lot closer than Morris, but I want to be far enough away where I'm not getting full of grass every time I put my lure out. If you're bringing your lure in to clear the grass, you're not catching fish.
Right.
So I'm at least 30 feet away usually. And now with what you're saying, I could be a lot further away and still do good.
Yeah. Well, and in your past experience, and if I'm on a smaller boat, I'll go closer. But I'm actually running a boat yesterday.
You're running an apartment complex.
It's 23 feet wide and 82 feet long, so I stay a little further
away.
His
boat is wider than mine is long.
So, but long story short, everything dines there. When you see if you're out in the deeper water and you see, even in 80, 90 feet, and you see a big clump of weeds out there or a line of it, that is basically like the big flashing sign out front of a diner. It says, eat here.
Gotcha. All right. So where did you end up? How far out did you say you ended up?
We were 92, 93 miles at the furthest
and
point.
And
we
deep found water current. Is that?
That's 430 feet.
Now, did you try and bottom fish there, or were you pretty much just trolling?
No, we were trolling there. It's not a lot of fun to bottom fish in that water. So we came in another 10 miles, and we're in 245 feet then. And we did some bottom fishing there, and we caught some snowy grouper, scamp, yellowmouth. These are usually deep water species, and you'll catch smaller scamp and yellowmouth in closer along the reefs and ledges, but these were like 10 to 15 pound size fish.
All right.
But
now,
you're fishing a true ledge, not what we're used to considering.
Yeah, no, this ledge that we're
here,
fishing.
You said you moved 10 miles closer and you literally dumped 200 feet.
Yeah.
That's a pretty significant drop. So, we're used to 2 feet, and that's
how
huge,
tall is
so.
This ledge?
Well, here's what I was fishing on. The Christmas Ridge area, which is the area I fished on, is actually where the Gulf continental shelf starts to change from the shallower waters that we're used to and gradually sloping. So at the Christmas Ridge, the Gulf bottom goes from 235 feet to almost 300 feet. On the ledge, they're basically big, huge ledges and shelves and peaks and all kinds of bottom there. So, and when you go over the ledge, the Christmas Ridge, and you get into the 300 feet of water, then 400 feet comes really quick because the bottom is sloping off rapidly there. Because another 20 miles out, it's 700 feet, and another 25 miles out, it's 7,000 feet.
That's a pretty good drop off.
And this Christmas Ridge is part of the Middle Grounds, isn't it? Part of the Elbow, part of the Pulley Ridge. It's all they're all very much almost in line with each other off the coast of Florida.
Yeah, the difference is that, the area of the Middle Grounds that's associated with Christmas Ridge and Pulley Ridge, that's a little further offshore due to the contour of the state of Florida. Right. So it's that can be quite a ways out, and it happens in shallower water to boot. You know, it's the middle grounds are like 140 to 185 feet of water.
Right.
And, you know, here we're talking 300 feet of water.
Right.
Now, do you use different bait bottom fishing out there than you do inside?
No, we didn't. We actually used the exact same outfits that we use in 80 or 90 feet of water, just, you know, an 8-ounce sinker instead of a 6-ounce. And we used live squirrel fish, cigar minnows, grunts, and whole squid.
Okay. Now, you caught, what, sailfish, marlin the other day?
Sailfish and a white marlin.
Okay, so you had a white marlin on. Were you trolling ballyhoo, or what were you? What did you put out behind the boat to actually get this?
Literally, we put out a spread of six rigged ballyhoos, some with just a rigged ballyhoo that is plain and rigged to swim, so it swims like a swim bait. And the other ones have little feathers and little tiny lures on them that don't really impede the swimming of the ballyhoo, but just put a little pop or flash to it. And we put those out via our outrigger system. And then we put a couple flats out. So we're literally pulling six baits off of the boat at one time.
About how far back?
That depends. Flat baits are usually anywhere from 25 to 40 feet behind the boat. Short outrigger baits can be 40 to 60 feet behind a boat. Long riggers can be anywhere you want them back there. But, you know, you basically do like a W with it. You know, you want them to come in and do
now,
that.
Now, here's one of the things. And, yes, we are putting in a huge offshore section at Fish and Frank's because there is white marlin out there. There's bonita out there. There's blackfin tuna. There's, I mean, Morris can go on and on and on. And Morris is coming in to help me choose a massive new selection of this offshore stuff, because right now what people are finding with all of the different stuff going on, you've got this whole right along the beaches and the intercoastal waterway, we're getting hit with red tides, we're getting hit with blue-green algae, we're getting hit with all these strange things. So a lot of people are going back to freshwater bass fishing. They're going out deep into the Gulf. And so this little section, there's still a lot of people fishing the flats, but people are looking for something a little different. It's been 30 years of let's go on the flats. And now a lot of people are going, hey, I want to go back, do a little bass fishing. I want to go out and do some deep water. And so we're going to be doing a lot more with the deep water stuff and a lot more with the bass stuff. We're literally after the first of the year renting another room, and it's going to be nothing but freshwater baits. It's going to be bass heaven. And but getting back to this, Robert,
yeah,
if you don't feel like going 100 miles out, what's going on in the Gulf?
In the Gulf, basically 10 to 20 miles out is kind of the magic number right now, because there's been a couple of patches of red tide at that 3 to 7 miles out, so it's debatable. You have to kind of guess. And so if you go 10 miles or better, you'll be fine, from what I've been hearing. A lot of mangrove snapper and lane snapper out there, and basically that 55 to 70 feet of water seems to be really productive for that.
Yeah.
Along with some grunts and porgies for all of your bottom fishing. As far as grouper goes, you got to go out a lot farther than that with any consistency. It's been basically that 100, 130 feet of water seems the most productive for your more legal size red grouper, gag grouper, and especially your AJs. You know, it's not an in-close thing right now, but the in-close grocery shopping for the smaller stuff, 10 to 20 miles, there's still some Spanish mackerel out there.
A lot of Spanish.
Little tunny, bonita, whatever you want to call them. Been the occasional blackfin, which I haven't heard much about lately, but there's always a few around. If those bonita are out there, there's always a good possibility of a blackfin tuna, so it's a super pleasant bycatch. And then there has been some reports of some cobia. And probably one of the best pleasurable things right now out there, but you're going to have to work at it and move from spot to spot. There's some really good permit activity out there on all those reefs in that 10 to 15 mile mark. I mean, I got a couple guys. There was one captain who's like amazing at it down in Fort Myers. He's fishing out there somewhere, and he had several fish that he showed this week that were in the 40-pound range.
Oh, yeah.
There was some really, really quality permit that he's been on.
And now, for either one of you, how do you go about, you just kind of pull up somewhere and then look for permit, or do you kind of, like, smell the breeze, taste the water, see if there's, you know, fish fart bubbles coming up? I mean, I don't know. How do you go about finding
the... Should I do this, Robert?
Sure.
You have to get a permit.
Oh, you have to get a permit to get a permit. Gotcha. Okay.
No. Well, best places to find permits around artificial reefs and wrecks. And the best way to find those for the average guy out there is to look on the charts and look at the coordinates posted for these places. Almost every one of those places will hold permit. And to target.
So it doesn't matter if it's on a posted, you know,
no.
Say, oh, I don't want to go to the tourist spot because I'm not going over there. Everybody goes there. And so what you're literally saying is, okay, get over yourself. Put on your big boy pants and say, it's okay if I go to a spot listed on the chart.
Well, permit like elevated structure. They aren't looking for that little ledge or hard bottom. They actually like stuff that is off hanging, coming up from the bottom.
Your permits are a lot like your amberjacks.
They want that structure. They want that big relief coming off.
So is there any chance when you get there you can actually see what you're trying to fish for?
In some instances.
How do you,
if it's quiet and the surface calm and... And they haven't been spooked because they're very spooky. They will actually come right up on the top, dorsal fin and tail out, and they will just mill around on the surface like a big redfish or a bonefish just waving his tail around. They'll circle around in enormous schools. But as soon
it's
as boats show up.
A bunch of little sword tips sticking out of the water.
Yeah. Okay. As soon as a boat shows up, you know, then they'll settle down. They won't come up.
All right. Let's say you're the boat that showed up and you pulled up and you don't see anything because you were coming up, you didn't see anything. What's the best way to figure out if there's permit on that reef? You know, you're not experienced, you really don't know what you're looking for. What would you drop down to try and find permit?
I'm going to set up a drift. Me personally, I mean, and Morris has a lot more experience than I do with it, but I'm going to figure out which way the wind and the tide is going before I get to the reef. I'm going to do just a practice drift. See how my boat's going to set up. And I'm going to use a crab is the ideal bait or a shrimp. You know, as far as natural baits. Artificial-wise, it can be tricky. You can get them to hit like a DOA shrimp or gulp shrimp, sometimes even a paddle tail, but it's primarily a natural bait thing. And I'm either going to use the technique that Morris taught me, which is basically a quarter ounce or a half ounce jig head with the crab on it.
Or lighter.
Or a split shot on it. And I'm going to cast those out probably in front of the boat as I'm drifting up to the spot, so that way they have time to sink down into the water column. And as we pass over it, then it'll raise that bait back up a little bit as I'm drifting along to try to cover multiple spots in the water column above the structure.
The permit of schooling fish. So when you do that, they're going to hit it. You're not going to go fish for
now. One thing I got to clear up, though. If you're going to do this, don't throw the line in front of the boat. Throw it forward of the boat, but off to one side.
Correct.
Because if you throw it right in front of the boat, it's going to get tangled up under the boat. What Robert was trying to say is he wants to get it up further, so as the boat drift closer to it, the bait has time to go down into the water. If you throw out to the side of the boat or the back of the boat, you end up dragging the bait with you, and it usually brings it up closer to the surface. So if you can cast it out forward of the boat, but not in front of the boat, it allows it more time to sink, get down there. By the time you get over the top of it, then as the boat passes it, it literally starts to pull it back towards the surface. So that's the most successful way to drift. Casting a line forward, letting it sink underneath, letting the boat pull it back up, cast and repeat. Now, sorry, Morris, what were you saying?
Oh, well, just think of the permit. He's not an individual fish that's going to be cruising around. There's going to be a lot of permit cruising around. So when you present a crab over one of these artificial reefs or wrecks, if you don't get a bite right away, you know, within the first 10, 15 minutes of it, just set up and try it different. You know, you can go to a different portion of the reef and drift across. And this is something that you do on a calmer day. If it's windy, then I would highly recommend setting your anchor out, swinging the stern of your boat so you're not on top of the wreck, but you're up current of the wreck a little bit, and doing the same procedure and floating those crabs back. A chum bag would even help.
Now, same type of chum bag you'd use for a shark, or?
Just some of the prepared stuff that they sell at the
just the stuff in the box or the bag.
Yeah, it works great.
At Fish and Frank's.
At Fish and Frank's.
Yes. at a store. No, there is one store. There's only one store.
No, there's two Fish and Frank's.
I know, there's two. Okay. RJ, you a permit guy?
I like catching permit. One thing I've enjoyed is diving the wrecks and watching how permit behave. And, you know, they're skinny when you see them this way, and then they're big when you see them sideways. And to see the school suddenly turn is pretty exciting thing to see.
But they're not individuals, are they?
No, it's always a school. I don't think I've ever seen just one permit. Usually you see 20 or 30 permit. And the other thing, we were talking about how they swim on the surface, and I think that's part of their feeding process because they're a look-down fish. You know, they attack from above, from what I've seen with permit, especially on the wrecks, you know, because you're stirring stuff up while you're down there, and the permit are coming from higher than you down to attack whatever it is that you've stirred up. So I think that's part of the feeding process when you see them on the surface like that. But, yeah, I like catching permit. I also like eating permit.
So. Now, a lot of people think pompano's way better eating than permit. Now,
I don't
RJ
agree with
seems
that.
To think that permit's great.
Permit are very tasty fish. I mean, they're better eating than pompano, as far as I'm concerned. They have less of a fish taste than the pompano does.
So, we've got better or worse than pompano, RJ.
Permit's better than pompano.
Okay, so we got two for permit. Pompano really sucking wind on this one. All right,
I don't have the palate to argue in any one of these. Yeah. RJ did make one point that is actually another way of finding these fish, especially once the sun is up. As you go past these reefs, looking down into the water with the clarity, their bodies shine like a mirror.
Oh, you'll see them.
Yeah. You'll see them 30, 40 feet down, reflect back literally like a mirror. And that can sometimes give away whether that reef is holding the permit or not.
And here's another point for those listening out there that want to try this. If you run your outboard motor over that area while you're looking for them, good luck. You know, you're on your own. But if you'll stop and shut that motor off and come across quiet with no noise, you'll have 100% better chance of seeing and catching a permit.
All right. Now, if you're going out and in the Gulf, how far out, what's the closest you think you would run into a permit or amberjack or anything at this point? Because from what I've noticed, in the summertime, the fish are further away from land than they are in the wintertime.
Well, I'm going to take the permit totally separate from the AJs. Because AJs generally,
that's
notoriously
fine.
For liking deeper water, the shallowest I've ever heard of them with consistency is the Palm Island ferry, which is what?
40 feet.
It's 65 feet.
Yeah, it's a little deeper.
Oh, 65?
Yeah, it's out by the crane barge.
But either way.
Yeah, I was there when they sunk it. I just, for some reason, I thought it was shallower. Yeah.
But that's the closest I hear of them in that way. But as far as the permit goes, I've seen them in as close as the Novak Reef, which is
3 miles.
I've actually caught permit on Johnson's Shoal and out on Stump Pass on the sandbar right at the pass.
So well, they yeah. could be right up by shore.
They are very much, when we're in the Keys or in the Bahamas especially, we catch permit on the flats. It's a flats fish.
And they mix in with the permit here, or the pompano on a very regular basis.
Yes.
But we're talking about the
bigger fish.
The bigger permit, let's say for
15 pounds is probably our largest one in the
shallow. So the general public, it's going to be any of the near shore reefs, literally Helens, Marys.
Now, will they come in this time of year when it's so hot, or will they stay out in the deeper water?
They like that. They like all of those reefs.
The only caveat is the red tide. If the red tide's in there, then they're going to tend to be in that
deep,
just on the outside of it, as close to the, you know, structure as they can be, but they're going to be somewhere away from the red tide.
All right. Now, do amberjacks, are they affected temperature-wise? Because summertime, the water gets a lot warmer, and I know the grouper push way out. Grouper like that cooler water. And in the reason in the winter, the water cools down, grouper come a lot closer to shore. Fish that you're finding now in 80 or 100 feet of water might come into 40 to 60 feet of water. I mean, you're going to get a few degrees difference in water temperature. That's going to bring a lot of them in.
Something to think about, too, in the Gulf is almost every year we get a thermocline. And what you'll have is you'll have 85-degree water up top, and then you're going to have cooler water down lower. So you'll go down in 60 feet. You can dive down, and I've dove many times out here. And when you get down to about 15 feet from the bottom, you're going to hit a cold water area where the water temperature is about 72. And that's almost breathtaking when you come out of 85-degree water. But when you get down in that area, you're going to see, you know, less because it's usually murky, but it is cooler. So there are some fish that are going to stay around year-round, but as a rule, you're going to get that migration in and out. Amberjacks this time of year, 80 feet or deeper usually.
All right, so because a lot of people think, oh, it's summertime, the fish are going to be a lot closer, and it's literally not true. We're very lucky when we have, no afternoon storms as a general rule. In the wintertime, the fish are much closer. You have much more accessibility to them. So if you've got a 20-foot boat or something like that, you want to go out into the Gulf, the cooler the water, the closer most of the fish will be to land.
And we're coming up on a magic time of the year, which is September, October, and November. When that transition from hot summer to fall happens, and you'll see a migration of fish starting to come in closer to shore, you'll see amberjacks in 60 feet, 50 feet in some cases. You'll see all these things coming back in. And
we'll okay. Now, into the harbor, on the west side of the harbor, there's a lot of trout, or I'm sorry, on the east side of the harbor, I know there's a lot of trout over there. You're going to catch and release a whole bunch of them to get the few keepers that are over there. There's not a lot of keepers. They're getting pretty good pressure. One of the things I heard, one of the guys came along the east, on the east side, and he said it was a parking lot because the redfish had moved back in. He said from Pirate Harbor up to Alligator Creek, the islands were full of boats, and there was just a lot of redfish up there. Anybody had any confirmation
of
that?
It's the same thing I've heard,
yeah,
too.
Same thing I've been hearing. It's been even getting a little better on the west wall, too, with people.
Well, it's basically ran any redfish that were coastal back up into the harbor where they...
Right. So there's actually quite a few redfish in harbor right now. If you just drift in the open flats, you can find some trout on the flats of the east side. Shrimp and popping corks, paddle tails. It pretty much everything seems to be working at this point on them. I don't hear of anything bad. Now, what's going on outside the bar on that east side, Robert? Anything?
Pompano have been schooling up there pretty well. So your trout are going to be up in that 2 feet of water all the way out to 5 feet of water across the flat, not into that deeper water. But the pompano seem to be concentrating more on the outside edge of the bar in that 3 to 5 feet of water. And then you've also got a lot of tarpon cruising up and down that east side.
All right. Morris, what's your favorite way to catch pompano? Is there something that just, okay, this is going to work?
I have two ways that I do. And one of them was before this, the Silly Willy jig or the Silly jig.
The banana jigs, yeah.
Yeah, before they were invented and in vogue, I used a quarter or an eighth ounce jig head, white or yellow, with the old traditional
bucktail.
Shrimp tail.
Oh, the
plastic
shrimp tail.
You know, and if it's got a paddle tail on it or a curly tail or something like that, I would go right behind the hook and cut it off.
Okay.
And I would just use the jig head and a little piece of plastic, and I would fish that exactly the same way as I fish the silly jig.
All right. Robert, give me a little bit about the tarpon. Where was your best bets right now?
They're primarily heaviest in the 20-foot holes all the way down to Cape Hayes and over even into Boquilla and the top side of Two Pines. And ladyfish is definitely by far the best food source for them right now. If you can throw out a ladyfish and drift through that area where you're seeing them roll or the occasional blow up, you're going to get them. But they've also been hitting pretty good on the 5 and 6 inch storm swim baits and the DOA bait buster, which is kind of the king. They haven't patterned themselves on one particular color, so everything seems to be working. But getting out there early has been the best bite. From sunrise until about 8 o'clock in the morning seems to be the most consistent thing. After that, they're just tarping.
All right. Yeah, they're just tarping. Well, there is food fish in the harbor if you want a dinner. I'm not going to say I'm thrilled with all of the stuff in the harbor because right now the water is very warm. Highest bacteria counts you're going to get is with this hot, hot water. Many parts of the harbor over 90 degrees. But the Gulf of Mexico's got some amazing fish in it. Really doesn't matter. If you want to catch fish, you can. It's just fun out there right now, and yeah. Freshwater fishing's doing pretty good. The flats are doing pretty good, and in the Gulf of Mexico, it's pretty darn awesome right now.
Yeah, you got to get out there, go fishing.
We got Fish and Frank here in the chair. Say goodbye, Robert.
Goodbye, Robert.
Hey, say something, Captain Morris Campbell.
Something, Captain Morris Campbell.
And saying goodbye, RJ.
Goodbye, RJ.
All right, I got a bunch of Henny Youngmans on my thing, and I love that you knew what I meant by that. Anyway, Fish and Frank. We'll see you in the next one.